Is it? All right.
John Adams, this is called Invocation, the first work from Coyote. Is it the opening piece?
Yes, it is.
I want to introduce you to the audience a little bit. For those who don't know who this gentleman is, I'd like to let you know that John Adams is a composer. He is first, and I think his first love, you may dispute that, John, that's your privilege, of course, is percussion. He is a percussionist and has been a percussionist with the Fairbanks Symphony and with the Arctic Chamber Orchestra for years. My sense is, and I will ask you to check this with me, John, in a minute, that your love of composing comes from your love of drums, of percussion, of sound in general. Is it the emergence that is that natural?
It certainly started there.
Yeah. The compositions that you folks may know are Forest Without Leaves, which is a work that was done with the poet John Haynes, and is a very definitely an environmental and an environmentalist's work. Northern Suite, another work you may know, Night Piece. All these are recorded on Opus One label, Forest Without Leaves on the Owl recordings. Also Songbird Songs, which came from John's pausing to listen to the songbirds of the Southeast in America. Yes.
Right.
The work you may know best is the work we began with, the opening number of Coyote. Coyote Builds North America was an invention by John Adams, musically, by members of the Perseverance Theater in terms of staging, by, give me the gentleman's name.
Barry Lopez.
By Barry Lopez, a very well-known author who began to collect the writings and stories about Coyote.
Right. Of course, the original source is the mythology of Native America.
But this, it seems to me that you people dreamed this and created it on a stage for everyone to have. I get that sense from how it was put together. Lovely work, anyway.
A lot of fun, too. I'm looking forward to reviving Coyote.
I mentioned at the top of the hour that Coyote is going to go away from Alaska with some old players and some new players.
That's
yes,
right. Yeah.
And go to the East Coast. Why don't we pause and do that nuts and bolts bit and tell people who might know people on the East Coast that where this performance is going, we can call our friends.
Great. Yes, we leave on March 14th, I believe, a week from Wednesday. And it's a 5-week tour of the East Coast, including performances at Dartmouth and Boston and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and other locations in Rhode Island and Maine and Vermont and one or two other places in New Hampshire as well. So it's sort of up and down the upper eastern seaboard.
You can be working with students as well as with audiences.
Yes,
right?
We actually begin with a residency at Dartmouth where we will be pulling the work back together. It's really substantially a new work. It's been a work in progress for 4.5, 5 years now. And it has changed quite a bit since it toured Alaska back in 1987. There's all new choreography. There are stories that were in the original production that have been cut, other stories that have been added. And there's lots of new music that's been composed in the last, most of it in the last year or so. And a new musical ensemble also, which is just a wonderful group of musicians.
How exciting. Well, how
the
is
group
it
that we just heard. That was a rehearsal tape.
Oh, this is a rehearsal tape. Right. Oh, I thought that'd come from the past performance. So we're getting a glimpse into a new, two
right.
new works.
Right, yeah. Actually, that opening piece was originally a drum duet. There were only two of us who played percussion in the first production. And now in the new production, the violinist and the bass player, as well as the other legit percussionist and I, all play percussion. So there are 4 and soon to be 5 percussion quartets in the new version of Coyote.
Oh. Quite exciting. How large will be the ensemble you're taking?
Well, the ensemble is 5 players. Originally, it was 4. The musical ensemble, that mm-hmm. is. Originally, it was only 4. Ted DeCorso playing clarinets, the little piccolo clarinet and the bass clarinet, not the regular B-flat, but mm-hmm. both extremes of the family, violin, and 2 percussion. And to that, for the new tour and the new incarnation of Coyote, I've added double bass. And as I said, the bass player, Robert Black, who's from New York, and our new violinist, Robin Lawrence, who is from Los Angeles, plays with the California Ear Unit, both have percussion in their backgrounds. So it was a wonderful opportunity for me to kick it out a little more with the percussion pieces.
Sure. And have they fallen in love with this work?
Oh, we've fallen in love with the whole thing. Yeah.
Again.
It's a great group of musicians. We get along musically very, very well, and personally, it's just a lot of fun. We're having a good time, and I think that will be heard.
What is it like to transform a work in place? I mean, this work has been staged, been produced, been performed, been created. In some ways, some people would think, well, you put a period on that and then you just repeat it later. Mm-hmm. How is it to transform it?
Well, I'm a chronic reviser, I guess. I've come to feel over the years that there are certain things that can best be done on the spur of the moment very quickly, and when the ink dries, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole different quality to work that emerges over a long period of time. You begin to discover deeper and deeper layers in what you're working on, and Coyote is certainly a work that falls into that category for me. It's very exciting to come back to it with fresh ears and eyes and try to look at it as something you've stumbled onto, almost a found object, and make it better than it was before and something more than it was before. Very excited about the choreographer we've engaged for the new production to a fellow named Doug Elkins, who is from New York City and does very, very dynamic, athletic choreography, which should be very appropriate for not only Coyote, but for the music, too.
Let's listen to another piece of the music. This coming up
Great.
Is Coyote's Dance. Is this transformed as well?
Well, the only thing that's changed here since the original production is the addition of double bass, which really grounds the whole ensemble and just gives it kind of almost at the bouncy jazz feel at times. It's very complex rhythmically.
Not to mention a puckish feel.
Yes.
This piece is puckish. Thank you. John Adams. We've been listening to his work. Tell me, John.
That was Coyote's Dance.
This is Coyote's Dance. Right. I'm thinking ahead. I'm sorry. To Coyote's Dance from the work Giving Birth to Thunder, Sleeping with His Daughter, Coyote Builds North America. A mythic piece about a mythic character. I think the thing I like best about Coyote is that he is both God and human, and in addition to those two, none of the above.
A lot like all of us.
Yes, and a lot like all of us. There was one commentary in that I read in thinking about Coyote that was that most of us are looking for answers to life. Why is life? And in some ways, Coyote, the mythic creature, provides the answer. At least, what is life? Mm-hmm. What am I? Mm-hmm. I am perfect and imperfect, and I stumble, and I'm greedy, and I'm tacky and lascivious, and all the things that...
Coyote, of course, exists in many different incarnations and cultures all over the world. He's not uniquely Native American, although in this particular incarnation, he certainly is.
But the Roman and Greek gods had... creatures like Coyote
literally all over the world. There's sure. There's monkey in China, there's fox in Japan, and the eastern woodlands of the United States. It's the great hare. The trickster figure, as Barry Lopez says, is the oldest figure in human legend. And really, well, Jung gave quite a bit of thought to Coyote and came to the conclusion that Coyote represents what he called undifferentiated human consciousness. That is, our humanness before we began to make distinctions between right and wrong, good and evil. And so Coyote really does embrace the full spectrum, from the basest to the most divine, the full spectrum of human nature. Coyote has been described in so many different ways and called so many different names, but one that I like very much is James Kohler, an American poet, who says, Coyote is he who made the world and then didn't know what to do with it. Which sort of says it all about human beings, I think.
John, Coyote is a rich source of music as well as information on why we are what we are. I want to think about that rich source in a context of something you wrote. The piece is called Resonance of Place. You mused on what you called the rich diversity of musics around the planet in that piece, and then you followed by asking, but how did the music of the natural soundscape influence the birth and growth of these traditions? How might closer listening to the rhythms of place contribute to a renewal of our musics and our cultures? Would you explore that thought with me here and now? I think a thought like that led to the piece of work that we're going to listen to next on this program, an excerpt from Earth and the Great Weather.
Uh-huh. Certainly. I'm not interested in music apart from culture or apart from life. My concern as a creative musician is to try to make some sense out of this world and this time in which we live, and to connect the work that I do with some larger sense of change. And I mean that in a fairly specific political sense, but also in a larger cultural sense as well. And those questions that I ask rhetorically in Resonance of Place, this essay that you're quoting from, are more important than the answers to those questions. I would say they're ultimately unanswerable questions, but the great American composer Morton Feldman, who just died a couple of years ago, used to say, love the questions, in his Brooklyn, inimitable Brooklyn accent. The questions really are more important than the answers, how we formulate questions, how we ask the right questions at the right time is really what it's all about to me.
Where is our attentiveness now as a culture? Where is our attention?
I'm afraid we don't have a lot of attention now as a culture. We have a very, very short attention span. And that's one of the things that I believe those of us who are working with sound and with new kinds of music are trying to do. We're trying to learn again how to listen carefully, how to listen deeply, and be attentive to what is all around us and as well to what's deep inside of us.
Molly Smith said, the woman who directed Perseverance Theater in Coyote, said that while she was putting together her first thoughts on her end for Coyote, she also read an article which contained the thought, this is a time of great composers, and no one is listening to new music.
Yeah, I remember her saying that, and I had forgotten about that. who am I to say? I guess time will tell. These things always take time, don't they, as most good things do. But I would say that the musical life of the 20th century has been incredibly rich and diverse and vigorous. And you bet there have been great composers that have lived in this century, and there are great composers who are alive now. And many, if not most of those composers, I would argue, live in the New World, live in the Americas. So it's a very confusing and difficult time in which to try and practice this arcane art of composing music, of pulling sound out of the ether.
And the 20th and 21st century composers may be living in a room of their own in some ways.
Well, I think many of us are committed to living in both worlds at once. I think in order to be a deep listener, in order to be a composer, you have to live in your own place. There is a kind of attentiveness that comes only when one is alone. But at the same time, I think many of us are concerned with the state of the world and the state of our culture, and if I can be so bold as to say, the spiritual condition of humanity. And it's important not to forget that, and to be both in the world and not of the world, I guess, to quote one of the great prophets.
And are all these thoughts what took you to the Arctic Refuge, for example, with your microphone?
Sure, without my really being fully aware of why. Yeah, and my love for that particular part of Alaska goes back some 15 years. In fact, I visited the Arctic Refuge during my first summer in Alaska 15 years ago, and I've been back any number of times since. In fact, Cindy and I were married in the Arctic Refuge.
Right.
And
it's a very, this last trip?
Yeah, it's a very special place to me personally. But I also think it has transcendent values for the human spirit.
When you packed up your DAT tape recorder and your microphone and a few good water carriers and went out to the refuge, can you describe, and to the other places, mm-hmm. can you describe for those people for whom this work, to which we'll listen in a few minutes, is not only a new concept, but one of which they're immediately uninformed. I mean, people will not know what you put together to put this together.
Sure. Well, as you said earlier, it's a new concept to me also, and I'm not quite sure what it is. You refer to it as a radio symphony, and I think that's fair. It's certainly symphonic in scope. It's a 27-minute piece. Mm-hmm. And when I was given the commission, they said, we'd like 26, 27-minute piece, and I swallowed hard and said, my God, that's a symphony. Mm-hmm. But it's also something else, and a term that I've been using to try and describe what I'm trying to get at in this piece, Earth and the Great Weather, is a sonic geography. And I'm not quite sure what I mean by that. But I've been very taken in the last year or two by a renewed interest in the power of sound, and the power of sound to do things and to touch on parts of us that visual imagery and language simply cannot reach.
In some ways, is there so much visual that we're no longer paying attention to the details of it?
Oh, I think that has a lot to do with what you were saying earlier, your question about attention.
Yes.
I think the eye is very easily distracted and is very fickle. And listening takes time. And it takes a depth of concentration.
It also takes some commitment of attention.
Absolutely.
The mind can be just as fickle. I find myself listening to something, and then a vagrant thought will come through, and if it's a conscious moment, I will realize that the vagrant thought canceled out the thing to which I was listening. So I must pay attention if I'm going to listen to something.
There are obviously different ways of listening and different levels of concentration, and I'm not here to argue that one should either listen or deeply or put wax in one's ears, but there are deep, deep qualities that one derives from music and from listening to the sounds of the natural environment that really only come with that kind of heightened attentiveness. And in Earth and the Great Weather, I've tried to, in a sense, transport a listener to a place through that kind of sustained listening. And then, as you're implying, there's a certain responsibility on the part of the listener. In fact, I've tried in the piece not to provide too many guideposts or tell the listener too much. I've tried to leave the richness of ambiguity open so that hopefully the piece will bear repeated listening. And on subsequent listenings, it will be different than it was, because you will be different than you were. There was a narrative element to the piece originally, which I and several other people, Linda Schandelmeyer and Peggy Shoemaker in particular, worked very, very hard. And then when I finally got into the studio in San Francisco to mix the piece, it was dropped. It was dropped partly because I simply had too much material for a 27-minute piece, but it was also dropped, I think, because I felt that it was too specific, that I didn't want this piece to be about a place or about listening, but I wanted it, in a sense, to be a place where someone goes to listen.
Let's go to this place with no more ado.
Little creek with lots of fish. Place where caribou can easily be caught. Place where polar bears come to burrow deep into the snow and have their cubs.
Sikhrikpak.
Arctic shrew.
Tilagmiutak.
Sinner's shrew.
Avingak.
Snowshoe hare.
Tingagaluk.
Arctic ground squirrel.
Itireak.
Arctic marmot.
Sorex arctic.
Naulayok.
Brown lemming.
Sorex sinerus.
Varying lemming.
Lepus americanus.
Porcupine.
Citalus parii.
Ermine.
Dicrostonyx torguatus.
Least weasel.
Ormota braweri.
Mink.
Imnaek.
Lemus sibericus.
Kayokto.
Erethizon dorsatum.
Teriganea.
Mustela herminea.
Amarok.
Mustela nivalis.
Havik.
Mustela visum.
Mountain sheep.
Umegimak.
Ursus arctus.
Red fox.
Ivy.
Ursus maritimus.
Arctic fox.
Rangifer tarandus.
Wolf.
Alces. Alces.
Wolverine.
Ovis dali.
Muskox.
Vulpes. Vulpes.
Walrus.
Agaveloa.
Lacopus.
Spotted seal.
Agavec.
Canis lupus.
Ringed seal.
Gulo. Gulo.
Bearded seal.
Ovibos muscatus.
Beluga whale.
Odobenus rosmarus.
gray whale.
Phoca vitulina.
Bowhead whale.
Phoca hispida. Erignathus barbatus. Delphinopterus lucas. Escrictius gibbosus. Baleana mysticetus.
A deep pond at the source of the river. One that stays all winter.
The music of Earth and the great weather, the latest composition by composer John Luther Adams, who is with me today on Sunday at noon.
That was about nine to ten minutes into the piece when we started. It's a 27-minute piece.
Did not enter from the beginning.
Oh, no, yeah. No. And that's just a little excerpt that we heard.
John, for those who may be wondering, I'd like to lead them to an answer to a question. The instrument that we heard is an Aeolian harp.
Uh-huh.
It may not be familiar to everyone. Tell people what that is.
Well, it's a very, very old instrument, that exists in various forms all over the world. It's simply a wind harp. That is a harp that is played by the wind. And what it does is very simple and very, very beautiful. It simply sits in the wind, and as the wind blows across the strings, which can be made of gut or nylon or steel or various materials, the tones of the harmonic series play, and the higher the wind blows, the higher the harmonics go. And as I was, I've wanted to work with Aeolian harps for years and years. I have a very dear friend in Atlanta who builds exquisite Aeolian harps. But I also have a very strong commitment to live performance. And I simply couldn't figure out a good way to use these harps in a live performance situation, in a concert setting. But as I started to think about working on Earth and the Great Weather, the idea kept coming back. And I was going, packing my things to go up to the Arctic Refuge, and it was literally the day before. I'd packed the tape recorder and all the blank tape and the battery packs and everything to go out and record the sounds of the place. But it began to dawn on me that really it's a very quiet place most of the time. And as I thought about it a little more, I began to ask myself, well, what is the keynote of that place? Keynote is a term that Canadian composer and sound designer Murray Schafer coined in his marvelous book, The Tuning of the World, to describe the sonic ground of a place, the sound against which all other sounds are heard. And as I thought about the keynote of the Arctic, I realized that it's the wind, especially on the north side of the Brooks Range, out on the coastal plain and in the foothills. The wind almost always blows at some intensity or other. So I threw into my outfit the smallest Aeolian harp that I had, and my friend Leif Thompson and I spent the better part of a week on top of a hill in the Okpilak River Valley recording these Aeolian harps, which then became the sonic ground of Earth and the Great Weather. And I should say that all the sounds in the piece are 100% natural, organic sounds, but the harps have been manipulated electronically in a very high-tech studio in San Francisco. We spent a lot of time overdubbing them according to a harmonic progression, grand progression for over the course of the whole piece, so that hopefully the listener travels, in a sense, through different regions, different places within that region, over the course of the 27-minute piece, and the harps are one of the things that take you from one place to another. It was a lot of fun, though, to deal with these wonderful, rich, complex acoustical sounds and try to process them, manipulate them, move them up and down in pitch, and overlayer them with all this high-tech equipment, which just could not make sense out of these sounds at all. It was just far too complex for a harmonizer or for a sampler. Yeah, the real stuff is just so wonderfully complex.
You have three voices also, three human voices, I should say.
Right. Speaking three different languages, English, of course, Inupiaq, and also Latin. And the voices are Doreen Simmons, who is the woman who speaks English throughout the piece, James Nagyak, who is our Inupiaq speaker, and Birch Pavelski, a very dear friend of mine, who is the recovering altar boy.
Yeah, the Latin speaker.
Right.
And I assume these three people, much like the Aeolian harps, did not gather cooperatively in one room and balance their sounds once against the other.
No, although I think this piece or a piece very much like it could be done in a concert situation, and I'd like to try that sometime if I could get a string orchestra or an orchestra that could play in non-tempered scales, natural tuning, and would be patient enough to play all those long notes. I'd like to try it in a live performance situation. But I made a decision in working with the voices for Earth and the Great Weather to treat them, in a sense, as I treated the harps. That is, just to record a harp or record a voice, a person speaking the text, and let them follow their own natural curves and rhythms, and then, after the fact, with one voice not having heard the other, begin to work with them and try to overlay them. We spent a very long and arduous day trying to balance and fine-tune the rhythmic relationships between the voices. There was a lot of hard work that went into the micro-rhythms, you might say, of the relationships between the voices, especially when there are three voices speaking, as there are in that section that we just heard. It was a lot of fun. And the idea wasn't so much to have all the words heard. In fact, it wasn't that at all. And they were speaking in the segment that we just heard. By the end of the piece, they're whispering, and you really don't hear it as language anymore. You just hear it as this wonderful shimmering sonority.
Well, I found when I listened to it yesterday afternoon that only periodically was it language for me, mm-hmm. after the beginning. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, I was interested in it as human language. But after that, it became part of a weave of sound. And only every now and then I would hear Whooping Crane, and I would remember that we were listening to.
Well, you got it then. The drums are a recurring element in the piece also, and I'm taking off on the wonderful energy and uneven pulses of Eskimo drumming. But James Nagyak's voice, which we hear at the beginning of the piece alone, intoning in Inupiaq place names of the Arctic Refuge, comes in right after a very slow, quiet drum beat, and his voice sounds just like a drum. He has a wonderful, rich, resonant voice, and really, in many ways, the voices are treated like drums, like percussion, throughout the course of the piece, although you're moving in and out of focus with the intelligibility of language also.
We're talking today with John Luther Adams, composer from the interior of Alaska, our own, as they say. This is Sunday at Noon. I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. John, you and I mentioned only briefly yesterday your interest in the power of radio to do what no other medium can do. If I can reflect that thought to you and blend it with another one, I wonder if you can think two thoughts together for me.
We'll see. If I could listen to three voices at once,
you can do this, plus Aeolian harps. In regards to the Far Country of Sleep, another composition of yours to which I listened yesterday, you talked about the silences in the work and how they disturbed the rehearsing musicians at first. They felt out of place in those silences and didn't know what to do with them. But when it came to the concert hall with an audience, the silences were powerful, empowered, and the musicians empowered by those silences. I am interested in your thought as to the interaction of an audience with a radio symphony of the type that you have created. Is that too vague?
No, I think it's a wonderfully rich and open topic. Radio, as we say often, especially at this time of year, radio is a very personal medium. And sound is a very personal thing also. To quote Murray Schafer again, sound is a way of touching at a distance. And that's not only a metaphorical touching, it's an actual touching because it takes air. It takes the movement of a column of air to make sound, and that column of air touches someone who's listening. And I think that's a particularly powerful, intimate relationship with radio. The piece we're talking about, Earth and the Great Weather, was commissioned by New American Radio, a series, national series out of New York, in cooperation with KUAC and with KPFT in Houston, Texas.
Pacifica Station.
Yes. The funding actually came from Meet the Composer and Reader's Digest. Can't believe that. But it was commissioned by New American Radio. And for listeners who have heard or maybe not heard New American Radio on KUAC, I should say that it's all about using radio as a creative medium of its own. You know, so much of what we hear on the air, on radio or we see on television, was originally conceived for another medium, whether it's the concert hall or the public podium or the theater or whatever. But there is a growing movement, you might even call it a radio renaissance, in this country and in Europe, of people who are trying to cultivate the creation of new works expressly for radio, works that take full advantage of the unique capabilities of radio to reach people and to do certain things that other media simply cannot do. So New American Radio commissions playwrights and poets and composers and people, performance artists, people who work in different disciplines to come into the medium and try and do something that is their own but also is different from what they've done before. And I'm really excited about it. I'd like to try it again.
Oh, good. Yeah. There is far more raw material than is in this work, Earth in the Great Weather.
Yeah, this piece actually grew out of a grand scheme that I've in mind called the Alaska Soundscape Project, which I began quite innocently and boldly, brashly last year. And the the purpose of it, I guess, is to go out and listen and bring back some of the sounds that are very unique to Alaska and to certain special places in Alaska. And I've realized as I've gotten into it, that it's going to be it's an enormous project, and it's going to be many, many years in the works, and it will probably result in many different pieces, not just sound pieces such as Earth and the Great Weather, but I'm equally, if not more, excited about several new cycles of instrumental pieces that are growing out of my reconnecting with these sources.
You have put your feet deeply on the earth, John Adams. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Sunday at Noon. I've been talking with John Adams today. We're going to walk away from you with the sound of very big boots from Coyote, a next piece called Convocation.
Consecration.
Consecration.
And it's a brand new piece. This was not in the original production.
Consecration from Coyote will carry us away. And then I'm going to invite John to stay for a few minutes on KUAC Sunday at Noon. For those of you who would like to know about the traveling dates for Coyote and also for the time of which you can hear Earth and the Great Weather, do stay with us on Sunday at Noon.
Thank you.
We have 10 drums, 4 drummers, very tightly scored, and that was one rehearsal of the piece called Consecration, a new addition, a new piece for Coyote, the newly transformed, but I sense transforming program.
Yeah, yes, continually evolving saga.
That will hit the road in less than 2 weeks, John.
Yeah.
March
yeah.
15th or so.
Yeah, I've got to get packed.
Not yet, stay here. A reminder.
Got more music to write.
A reminder for those who have friends on the East Coast or who are planning to make a trip. This program, Coyote, will be between March 15th and April 17th or so. John promised he would bring a schedule, but he'll bring it later and we'll know later. But this show will open in Dartmouth, go to Amherst, Boston, Rhode Island, University of Maine, New Hampshire, and to Vermont over the about 5-week period. So if you're interested in seeing it yourself, or if you, as I do, have friends and relatives on the East Coast, give them a buzz and let them know. They should look out for this show.
There's some Alaskans in exile in places like Boston
that sure.
we're going to be turning out. Yeah. Well, it should be fun.
Oh, I think it would be a great thing for the folks that I'm thinking of to be able to go to. Home at last,
yeah.
they'll say. They can wear their bunny boots. Also, for those of us, I would very much like to hear it again, who wish to hear Earth in the Great Weather, listen to KUAC-FM this Friday evening at 6:30, just after All Things Considered, when a special presentation of New American Radio will be on our air, and it will be Earth and the Great Weather.
It's the first time anyone's heard it.
Anywhere, anytime. John Adams. John Adams, before you leave me, I'm going to ask one additional favor of you. It's a few minutes before 1 o'clock.
You want me to write a check?
I want you to make this festival bridge with me. Someone will stop you before you get out the door to ask you to write a check. In fact, they stopped me and asked me to write a check. I pled poverty. There's a special number we invite people to call at this time of year, at this time of year only, to ask people for once in a year to send in a contribution to KUAC-FM and TV, and through that, sponsor our programs. That number is 474-6234. I will ask you outright, if you like Sunday at Noon, call in and let them know. Let folks know you like Sunday at Noon and why, and that you'll send in your contribution around this hour.
Public radio listeners are special people in general, and Sunday at Noon listeners are especially special people. It happens to be one of my 2 or 3 favorite programs on KUAC.
Well, thank you, John Adams.
I think the kinds of the diversity of programs that you bring to this community, the topics that you discuss on Sunday at Noon, the people that the guests that you have in are just extraordinary, and they add tremendously to the life of this community. I can't remember what life in Fairbanks was like without Sunday at Noon, and I don't care to think about it. And I'm sure that people who are listening now are very likely regular listeners to Sunday at Noon. And if you're listening to us right now and you fit that description, please give us a call. What is the number this year? 474?
474-6234.
As always.
As always. Do you know what I like best about Sunday at Noon? I like the people who come. I like the guests. I get to talk to people who say the most interesting things on a Sunday afternoon, and get to say them within my earshot. And mm-hmm. I think that is the thing I like best to give to people who listen, is the opportunity to hear those fascinating people say fascinating things.
Well,
I like it.
I'm a conversationalist. I like to talk.
Yes.
But I also like, better than talking, I like talking with or listening to interesting people. And we were talking earlier about the intimacy of radio, and I think that Sunday at Noon is a glowing example of that intimacy, where you can sit down in the privacy of your own home, or maybe driving to and from your house or going about your business, and essentially eavesdrop on conversations between you and an enormous variety of very, very interesting guests. So if you are someone who appreciates that kind of eavesdropping opportunity, then light up Susan's life this morning, this afternoon now. Give her a call at 474-6234. Let her know that you appreciate her and Sunday at Noon and KUAC in general. It'll just take a few minutes, and you'll feel better, and so will everyone else.
God knows I'll feel better. Do call 474-6234 if you do have thoughts about Sunday at Noon, and let the phone answerer know those thoughts. They'll help me. I mean, if there are people who don't like the show the way it's set up, I want to know. And I want to know what your hints and thoughts are about how you change it. Or subject matters I'm not getting to. Or subject matters I get to too frequently.
One of the things I like about Sunday at Noon is I never quite know what to expect. I sort of tune in and think, well, I wonder who Susan's talking to today. Am I going to want to throw things at the radio? Or am I going to really agree with this person? But that's, of course, not the point. It's the point is that it's stimulating. It's oftentimes provocative and informative. And there's just nothing else like it in interior Alaska. So thank you, Susan.
Well, thank you, John. These are very kind words. I didn't expect that. But I'm very pleased to participate in this kind of a program. I think when I first came to KUAC, I came sensing that although KFAR does a good job with what it does,
sure,
it's a provocative radio, it's opinionated radio, and it is talk radio. I never discovered on AR, which is the other alternative sound in this town, I never discovered a good deep conversation. I shan't say that totally. I didn't discover it frequently enough. And I wanted it.
As we were saying earlier, these things take time.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that you have an hour in which to probe and get into the inner workings of one person's mind and life and work is really something very special. What are you doing next week, by the way?
Next week I'm having fun. Isn't this nice? Next week I'm doing what I think of as the best of Sunday at Noon. I'm not an exquisite tape and razor blade producer yet, but I did take some of the favorite authors, my favorite authors who've appeared on Sunday at Noon over the last year plus, and kind of invited them via the tape to do readings from their works.
Great.
So there are...
Who,
there
for
are,
instance, you remember?
This is hard. See, you ask me. I know my mother's name. I know it very well. But
I'm turning
but
the tables on you now.
Yes, things that happened to me more than 10 minutes ago I have deep troubles with. However, Nancy Willard is a children's story writer of some note and of fine talents, and she reads a short children's story. It's a very short one. Rick Bass, who is the most recent author guest of mine, reads a nice little piece that I asked him to read while he was on the air with me. Robert Haas, reads a poem, fragment of a poem called January that just touched my heart. Mm-hmm. I like this a lot. And this wonderful man, oh yes, his name is Robert Butler from the South, talks about humidity in Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about it in such a down and dirty way that you can't help but grin. And finally in there is Jill McCorkle, who wrote the book Tending to Virginia, who talks about the death of her lead character's grandfather. Uh-huh. And it's they are such different pieces. And I found myself, when I was listening to these fragments of tape, laughing and then having my heart clutch up and then thinking, oh, how nice, and then laughing again. And so I thought, well, if it makes me laugh, maybe, and want to cry, maybe then this little waterfall of artists reading their works might be evocative for others. Then there's Jay Hammond is talking for a bit about what he'd do with his state economically and in terms of taxing.
That was a great interview.
It was a fun interview.
Hear that again.
Yeah, the part that I'm airing was a part that my beloved engineer John Christopite suggested, and that's the part, as it turns out, where I said, so God comes down and says, you can have another pipeline.
Uh-huh.
What would you do? And he says, Jay Hammond says what he's going to do, which is real good. Barry Tolkien, who is one of my favorite interviews, the folklorist from the Lower 48, who talked about urban and native folklore.
He's amazing.
Remarkable thoughts this man has. And then I couldn't let it go by without having the anthropologist, Brian Fagan, because he just is a language weaver, and talking about Beringia. And I'm trying to fit in a last piece. I mean, fit in, here we are just raging right over our hour. I'm sure our poor radio manager is sitting on the other side of the door saying, stop, stop, the opera's coming. But if I can fit it into the hour, I want a short piece of the Margaret Murray interview.
Oh, that's a great interview.
Conservationist, early Alaskan.
I've heard that one twice, I think.
Yeah, and a fine woman. This woman is, I forget, 86 or 87 now, and still as powerful as she was as a young woman. So I am hoping...
Truly a best of Sunday at noon.
I'm hoping to weave all those into 1 hour. Plus, I want to have Ann Thornton, our news person, in to introduce her new public affairs show that's going to air on Wednesday night.
Okay.
So a few minutes with Ann besides. And that's next week on Sunday at noon.
Well, so listeners who may be regulars of Sunday noon will get a reminder of what a wonderful program it is with this kind of retrospective next Sunday. And maybe listeners that are new to Sunday at noon will get an idea of what the program is all about. If you fall into either of those categories and you're provoked by what Susan is doing here, you appreciate Sunday at noon, please give us a call at 474-6234 and make your pledge of support for public broadcasting to keep fine programs like Sunday at Noon coming your way.
We invite you to, and I also want to make a kind of a bridge appeal to our opera lovers. Our opera lovers are a passionate lot. When the opera moved from Saturday to Sunday a couple of years ago, the opera lovers were
incensed. We heard about it, yes.
Yeah, and we brought back that opera, which moved from one day into oblivion at that point. The Metropolitan Opera Company of the Air is back on our air on KUAC. It is on Sunday afternoons, and it is especially for you, for people who are lovers, passionate lovers of opera. It is a gift from KUAC in some ways, and it is a gift given willingly, much like Weekend Edition, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. These are gifts given willingly to the Fairbanks community we know adores them most. If you are an opera fan, I'm not sure that's a correct connection of words, but if you are an opera buff, a lover of opera,
aficionado,
thank you. Call us at 474-6234 and tell us that. We've invited you to say you love Sunday at Noon for the past 7.5 minutes. We'll invite you now to phone in your support of the opera. 474-6234. This is Susan McInnes with John Adams, sending you to Kathy Thomas and Moira Moles.